Hello and welcome to a new edition of RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior. This is the international service of the Argentine Radio, transmitting from the city of Buenos Aires via the shortwaves of WRMI, Miami Radio International, and also via internet on rae.com.ar. My name is Fernando Farias, and together with sound technician Ana Maroto, we're going to be bringing you this show in English for Wednesday, April the 1st, 2026. On today's program, we're going to be talking about the Malvinas War, because tomorrow, April the 2nd, is the anniversary of the beginning of said conflict back in 1982, and it's a, well, very touching day for Argentines for various reasons. Argentines reassert the sovereignty claim over the Malvinas Islands. The veterans who fought in the conflict are honored. The fallen are remembered, and we reflect on this every April the 2nd. Because of that, on today's show, we'll be devoting the entire program to this. We're going to have a great interview that I recorded many years ago, that was in 2012, with two Malvinas War veterans that speak perfect English. We'll also be sharing content on Resolution 2065, the UN Resolution 2065, which acknowledges the existence of a territorial dispute between Argentina and the UK over the Malvinas Islands. And this is one of the main reasons for Argentina demanding London to sit at the negotiations table. And also on today's program, we'll be remembering hour by hour Operation Rosario. Operation Rosario is the code name for the amphibious operation that was carried out on April 2nd, 1982. Not just the beginning of the war we are remembering tomorrow, but also this military operation for taking over the islands exactly 34 years ago. But that will come a little later on today's program. If you want to get in touch with us, send an email to qslrai@gmail.com or a letter to Maipú Street 555, and then of course Buenos Aires, Argentina. Either way, it's okay for sending reception reports if you are at the AXA. Our frequency on the shortwaves of WRMI is 5850 kHz, and in addition to internet on our webpage rai.com.ar, you can also listen to us on your cell phone downloading our app for mobile devices, Digital Rai, available for free for both Android and Apple phones. We're going to start now with music. This is a song written by Ariel Ramírez and Atahualpa Yupanqui to honor the Malvinas cause. It's called La Hermanita Perdida, the Lost Little Sister. Perhaps the most popular version is that sung by Lolita Torres, which is this one.
Azules y encajes de espumas blancas, te va llegando el saludo. El saludo, permanente de la patria. Juanita vuelve a casa. Amarillentos papeles pintante con otra laya, pero son muchos millones que te llamamos hermana. Sobre las aguas australes planean gaviotas blancas, dura piedra enternecida por la sagrada. Ay, hermanita perdida, hermanita vuelve a casa. Malvinas, tierra cautiva de un rubio tiempo pirata, Patagonia te suspira, toda la pampa te llama. Cara, hasta que logres el gesto tradicional de la patria.
RAE, Argentina al mundo. RAE, Argentina, 面向世界.
RAE, Argentina vers le monde.
RAE, Argentina to the world.
RAE, 世界に向けて, Argentina.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
La RAE Argentina al mondo.
RAE Argentinian in die Welt.
RAE Argentina al mondo.
We're going to talk now about Operation Rosario, the amphibious assault on the Malvinas Islands. This is what happened exactly on April 2, 1982, which marked the beginning of the 74-day war between Argentina and the UK over control of this South Atlantic archipelago. By late March 1982, the South Atlantic was no longer a theater of diplomacy, but one of mobilization. Under the designation Task Force 40, the Argentine Navy had assembled a formidable fleet. At its heart was the destroyer ARA Santísima Trinidad, the tank landing ship Cabo San Antonio, and submarine Santa Fe. Their objective, Operation Rosario. The mission parameters were strict: seize the archipelago and its capital, called Stanley by the British, while avoiding British casualties to mitigate the inevitable international outcry. As April 1st drew to a close, the fleet sat positioned off the jagged coastline, shielded by a moonless night and a swelling sea. The operation commenced in the silence of the early hours. At 2100 hours on April 1st, the Santísima Trinidad came to a halt 500 yards off Mullet Creek. From her decks, 84 men came to a halt 500 yards off Mullet Creek. The men of the 1st Amphibious Commander's Group lowered 21 Gemini assault craft into the freezing spray. Led by Lieutenant Commander Guillermo Sánchez Avarots, these elite troops paddled towards the shore, landing at 0130. The primary target was the Moody Brook Barracks, the traditional home of the Royal Marines Naval Party 8901. 3 hours, the commanders navigated the treacherous, peat-covered terrain in total radio silence, moving like ghosts toward the high ground overlooking the settlement. Simultaneously, a secondary, more specialized insertion was underway. The submarine ARA Santa Fe surfaced near Cape Pembroke. In the darkness, 14 members of the Buzos Tácticos, the Argentine tactical divers, slipped into the water. Their task was reconnaissance and hydrographic survey to ensure the landing beaches at York Bay were free of mines and obstacles for the heavy armor that was to follow. By 0430, they had secured the perimeter of the airfield, signaling that the path was clear for the main invasion force. As dawn approached at 0600 hours, the silent phase of the operation transitioned into an overt display of military power. The ARA Cabo San Antonio approached the shores of York Bay. Her bow doors swung open and 20 LVTP7 Amtraks, 30-ton ambitious armored vehicles, roared into the surf, carrying the 2nd Marine Infantry Battalion. These steel behemoths rumbled across the dunes and seized the airport within 30 minutes. Meanwhile, at 0655, the amphibious commanders reached the Moody Brook Barracks. They unleashed a barrage of grenades and heavy machine gun fire, only to find the buildings deserted. The British garrison, alerted by intercepted radio traffic and intelligence from London, had already repositioned to defend Government House. The focus of the battle now shifted to the heart of Stanley. The climax of the operation centered on the residence of Governor Rex Hunt. A small detachment of commandos, led by Captain Pedro Giacchino, attempted to storm the rear of the building to force a quick surrender. They were met by a wall of fire from the Royal Marines. In the ensuing exchange, Captain Giacchino was mortally wounded, becoming the first casualty of the conflict. By 0800 hours, however, the tactical reality for the defenders had become grim. The LVTP7 armored vehicles had reached the outskirts of the town, the 30mm cannons providing a psychological and physical weight that lightly armed Royal Marines could not match.
From the governor's office, the sight of Argentine armored columns moving down the streets signaled the end of effective resistance. At 09:15, Governor Hunt, seeking to prevent further loss of life among his men and the civilian population, ordered a ceasefire. Negotiations took place within the government house, and by 09:30, the formal surrender was signaled. Within hours, C-130 Hercules transport aircraft began landing at the captured airfield, ferrying in the 25th Infantry Regiment to consolidate the occupation. Operation Rosario was complete. In under 12 hours, the Argentine military had executed a complex amphibious maneuver, achieving every strategic objective with a level of coordination that remains a subject of study in military academies today. And thus, the Malvinas War began. That was a summary of Operation Rosario, the capture of the Malvinas Island by Argentine forces.
RAE, Argentina al mundo. RAE, Argentina 面向世界。
RAE, Argentina vers le monde.
RAE, Argentina to the world.
RAE, 世界に向けてアルゼンチン。
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
La RAE, Argentina al mundo.
RAE, Argentinian in the world.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
We're going to play now an archive piece. I recorded this in 2012 when Argentina, when we were remembering 30 years of the war. And I had the pleasure and the honor of interviewing two English-speaking veterans, Alejandro Meringer and Miguel Savage. And this is a package with the best parts of those two talks. Friends, here we are once again, RAE in English. This is a special edition on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of April the 2nd, 1982, the beginning of the Malvinas War. We have the great pleasure of being in contact with a veteran from that conflict, Alejandro Meringer. Thank you for being with us.
No, it's a pleasure being with you, Fernando.
Miguel Savage, who's in Venado Tuerto, the province of Santa Fe.
Hello, Fernando. Good morning.
How was your life, let's say, 3 months before April the 2nd, 1982?
In that moment, I was 18 years old before this action happened, because I turned 19 on January, so 3 months before that, I was 18. I was finishing high school on December of 1981, and I'm from the city of Bahía Blanca. Bahía Blanca is 700 kilometers from Buenos Aires to the south. It's my home city. It's where I grew up, part of my life, and the other part of my life I passed in the United States. Then I came back to Argentina and continued my life here. And I was planning on entering the university to study as to be a civil engineer. I received a telegram establishing that I had to present myself in the army because I was going to do my military service that I had to do for the country.
The conscription.
Yeah, exactly. The conscription. I was called on February the 2nd of 1982 for us to get in time.
Had you had any military experience before, or
no,
at least shooting experience?
No, I was just a simple citizen that, on the contrary.
A simple citizen, a kid.
The last time I hunted something with a gun was when I was 14, and I hunted some rabbits, and then I hunted never more again because I felt like pity for killing some kind of animal. So I was a nonviolent person on February. That's right. So we had that military preparation that they give you that we slept in around 45 days, I believe, was the preparation. And here also in Bahía Blanca, and which was the dependence of the Batallón of Communications, which is the one that finally took me to Malvinas.
The first thing I have to say is that we the Argentine conscripts, we weren't professional soldiers. We were students, we were working class, doing our our military service during the dictatorship. So we weren't soldiers by choice. That's one of the huge differences with us and maybe the British soldiers, the professional soldiers. So I was finishing my military service. I had 10 days for the final leave, and April the 2nd came, and that changed my life completely.
You were 10 days away from going back home?
Yes, just 10 days. I was going to resume my studies. I was going to study agronomy in La Plata, and I played tennis, I had a girlfriend, I had a normal life to live, and April the 2nd changed it completely. I'm now a different person. I'm a survivor. I don't know what would I
You don't
been.
Call yourself a veteran, but a survivor.
Yeah, I present myself as a survivor, and I think that in cherishing the simple things in life, that's my main strength, my main message, the principal message I like to convey to people, to enjoy simple things.
And we were 10 soldiers, the rest were all professionals.
Ah, okay.
Why? Because we took communication radios and we went to establish the communications between both islands and inside and between all the units. That was the destiny, the Battalion of Communications. 181 was destiny with which is in Bahía Blanca. In Constit, we had different companies, Company A, Company B, Company C, and the Company B, the one that I was, we were calling the flying, the Y-flying, because we were normally 1 meter over the floor, running and shouting and going and back and forth. The rest was sitting down, maybe ready, doing other activities, and we were continuously training and training and training, and at night while they were sleeping, we had training at night. And so I had a lot of contact with the old soldiers. The old soldiers, for the people to understand, were the people of the class before who were finishing their military service and who were doing guards. And while they were guarding us in that way, in some moments I had time to speak with some of them. And I got in good contact with them, and one of them said, "I am a friend of the assistant of the chief of the battalion," which was a lieutenant colonel.
Yeah.
"And I'm going to tell this friend of mine if he can recommend you." I said, "Okay, do it." Imagine a conversation at 3 in the morning that you're dancing like we had to do on those days, doing military dancing, and they say, "I never believe it was going to be true." But, well, they called me, and I stayed as I was selected as the assistant of the lieutenant colonel. For the people to understand, please, the assistant of a lieutenant colonel is not an administrative one, is not the one that does that. It's the person who cleans the room, attends the books, moves around the things. It would be like a butler.
Yeah.
Let's not give yourself a more important, say, "Oh, he's an assistant." No, I was the butler. That day, I was given a pass that the pass permitted. I found that pass, Fernando, and I was here, and I was scanning some of these old papers that I found because I didn't want to look at many of those things after the years. And this pass established that, I'll read it to you, it's very, very simple. It says, "Orden de salida permanente," or see, permanent going out or permit.
Yeah.
"By the present, I authorize the soldier, Meringer Alejandro, class 63, my document number, my military number, to go in and enter the unit." And it says, the porter of this documentation can be dressed as a civilian. That means that I didn't have to use a military uniform. And that this documentation cannot be retained in any place of entrance. Well, this is on March 19, 1982. March 19. Mm-hmm. So I was given this. Paso, I said, "Well, this is okay. I enter in a civilian. I do my work there as a butler. And after I finish my work at 3 or 4 p.m., I can go home and maybe I can prepare some subjects for the university, do some things." Passed a few days, and around the 25th, the 24th or 25th of March of 1982, when I entered, they said, "They're looking for you at the deposit." Okay. I went to the deposit, and they gave me a big sack. They gave me military clothes. They gave me a lot of utensils for eating. And after that, they said, you have to go to the armory. I went to the armory there, and they gave me a gun with all the chargers and everything. And I passed from being as a civilian to 100% military dressed and armed.
Yeah.
And I said, how many bad things could I have done in 4 or 5 days as a butler?
To be punished like this.
I must be the worst butler in the world, I said.
I got a telephone call to be in 1 hour at the regiment.
And you had no clue of what was...
No, I suppose we were going to just be there and while the others went to war, because I just had 1 day rifle practice. I had no proper training. So I was relaxed. I think they can't be sending me.
You were about to finish the conscription, but you didn't have any military training. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, correct. I just had 1 day rifle practice. This had occurred 14 months before in the basic training, and then I spent the rest of the 14 months in an office.
Yeah, administrative work, paperwork, nothing to do with guns and...
Nothing to do with infantry.
And then all of a sudden you were sent to the front. Is that just like that? I just can't believe that.
No, I ended up at the foot of Mount Longdon, one of the bloodiest battle of the Malvinas-Falklands War.
Wow.
We had to face the paratroopers, the three paras, the best regiment in the world at that time.
And they said no, that we were going to do some military movements, which was very typical, that goes nearby Ablanca to some farms or something and to practice, to do military practices on field. Well, okay, that was on a Wednesday. I stayed. Normally I left and went to my home to sleep. On these days, I stayed in, so I slept in the unit on the 25th, the 26th, the 26th. On the 27th, Saturday 27th, my chief said to me that, go home, go to your family, say goodbye to them, and tell them that we're going to do some military actions nearby Ablanca and that we're going to be out for some time. We don't know how much it's going to be, weeks or a month, but we're going to do some military exercises.
You arrived on the islands on April the 2nd, the very first day of the...
No, we arrived about 10 days later.
Okay. But airborne or shipped?
We went by plane, yes.
Obviously, you were scared.
We were just... At the beginning, yeah, scared and not believing that they were sending us. I couldn't believe it. It was like there must be some kind of mistake here, or maybe they're using us to as an act of presence, of military presence, and maybe they'll negotiate with the British. We never imagined the hell we were going to go through.
Wow, and that you would say that was the feeling among most of your comrades in arms.
Yeah, we were just, the first week we were, yeah, it was a bit funny, yes, first planes flying, and it was funny. But then when they started bombing us, it stopped being funny, and it became a very, very painful and excruciating experience.
So up to there I went, and I came back to the unit at 4 or 5 in the morning. When I arrived, there was a lot of movement. I got on a jeep with my chief and two other officials. And we start leaving the unit, and my chief started asking me, so you know English? And I said, yes. And you've been living in the United States? Yes. Well, talk to me in English. And I started speaking. We went to the naval base that was nearby Ablanca, which is in the city of Punta Alta, which is Base Naval, which is naval base Puerto Belgrano, which is the biggest naval base Argentina has here. And you can't imagine the amount of ships that I saw. It was like watching those movies from the Second World War or something like that. Incredible, the amount of people and ships and everything. And one of the persons that belonged to the battalion, I asked him, what are we going to do? Because I said, we're going to do some exercises in Pihue. Well, Pihue, for the people to understand, is a city that is nearby Ablanca, which is around 150 kilometers from the seaside. So if we were going to go ship there, that means that we were all underwater.
Yeah.
This was all flooded.
Yeah.
There was no way we were going to go to Pihue by water.
Say that it's like going to do Navy exercises to Oklahoma.
Yeah, exactly, or in Iowa. It was impossible. Or do it in the middle of Córdoba, which is the center of the of Argentina. It was something that had, it was ridiculous with the answer. We got on the ship. I went to Malvinas on the Almirante Irizar, which is the icebreaker. We got on the ship, and around late afternoon, it shipped out from Puerto Belgrano, and an officer came to Marcelo, which is a friend of mine that we spent all the time in Malvinas together. This officer said to us, practically, these are the exact words, we're going to make history. We're going to recover the Islas Malvinas. We're going to recover the Islas Malvinas.
Was there really any true military muscle deployed on the islands during those days that you could say that you could rely on and say, okay, well, when these guys show up, or it was just conscripts?
No, basically conscripts. Our company, 150 men, we just had two or three officers and about 10 NCOs. The rest were civilian conscripts.
Have you got any idea why was that? I mean, is there any explanation for this from the military strategic point of view?
Well, I have my conclusion. They used us as a kind of effect to produce the effect for the British not to come. The thing is, and then we were supposed to leave. The thing is that when Galtieri got all this nationalistic support in Plaza de Mayo, everybody with the jingoism going on at that time, I think he found it difficult to bring us back. So he just said, well, let's carry on with this story.
But why didn't they send, trained soldiers to the islands?
That's really incredible, because at that time in Argentina, the dictatorship, there was plenty of professional soldiers, commandos all over the place. They would have won Mount Longdon if they had sent professional soldiers.
Yeah. It makes complete sense. They were ruling the country. They had all the resources at their disposal, and yet they didn't send the best they have to the front?
Yeah, that's the same question the British soldiers ask me still today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They say, well, Maggie Thatcher was talking real business. She sent the best she had, and we sent just students.
And I said, and I asked this officer, aren't we going to go to war like this? And he says, no, we're going to take the islands, and then the high authorities will establish what's going to happen. Because the person that said it to me is a very, very good person, an excellent person, and he's a major. He was the second in our unit. He told us in confidence, inclusive when he told it to Marcelo and me, he said, you don't repeat to nobody on the ship because nobody's to know. Many people you found out on the ship knew the things, but we as soldiers, the rest of the soldiers had no idea where we were going. Well, we started navigating down there, and the Operation Rosario, which was named, of taking the island, was supposed to happen on April the 1st, not April the 2nd. The weather made it impossible for us to disembark on April the 1st. That's why we disembarked on April 2nd. We should have done it 24 hours before.
So you arrived there on the second, the very first day.
Yes, at 8 in the morning. On a helicopter from the Irizar, which was this icebreaker, I arrived at the airport, at the old airport, which is one of the points of the islands of Puerto Argentino. And we enter with Marcelo sitting in the back of a Land Rover with our guns prepared to shoot. They said, prepare your guns to shoot at any moment if it's necessary, because there was still fighting in the house of the governor with the Royal Marines when we arrived. We started entering the small town and looking everywhere, because in this moment we had no idea if the population was hostile or not, or if there was that we had the message that we had to be prepared to shoot, not because of the population, but because they were not sure if there were Royal Marines distributed in different places, and that they were waiting for us to pass to attack us. Mm-hmm. That was the reality, not for the population, but because there would be more military. Imagine Marcelo and my case how scared we could be.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, because you weren't trained military, you weren't even trained conscript. You had just started four months before. You were just a student.
Exactly, because I was class 63. I had 45 days where in the shooting gallery we had shot six times. When I talk about five or six times, not 5 or 6 days. 5 or 6 bullets.
Let's period.
Put it this way.
Literal.
Nothing. We had no way, and we were terribly scared. That's why I always say that the difference between somebody who is a coward and somebody who is supposedly called a hero, practically they are the same person. The only difference is that the coward is not a bad person. It's that he is dominated by this fear. And the person who has some hero actions, he has dominated his fear. On the other, the fear has dominated him, but it's not that he's a bad person. And in that way, it's a question of dominating or not the fearness that you have. Well, we were terribly scared. Somebody who say that he wasn't, it was. But it was a strange mix. I remember when Fernando, when I got off the helicopter and I stood on the land, I felt like I had to do like the Pope, kiss the land, because the ship had moved so much during the last 3 days that I had nothing in my stomach.
Miguel, where exactly were you deployed on the islands?
I was at the foot of Mount Longdon. That's about 10 kilometers away from Stanley, Puerto Argentino.
Okay. That's the place where you stayed all of your tour to the islands.
Yes, I spent 60 days there, huddled in a peat bank, starving. We had no food. We had no solid food. We just had
soup.
Yeah, a very liquid kind of soup and mate, a bitter herbal tea during the morning. Never bread, never biscuits, nothing.
Was there any, explanation for that? I mean, no supplies. Why?
That's also very difficult to explain. They had all the food in sheds in the village.
Were you engaged in many combat situations during your 2 months plus?
We were more inside the city, inside the town, and going out. I was crossed by enemy fire, and I was shot by Argentine fire also. And the nervousness of that in various situations, I was shot by our own troops. Thank God I wasn't injured, and I can tell this, but we were in a better situation because we were inside the town.
After the first week of starving, we just abandoned our position and went to steal food, our own food from the sheds.
On your own? I mean, you just broke ranks.
Yes. We picked the rainy days when the officers were sleeping in the tents, and we just escaped from to steal food. The thing is, when we were caught, we were brutally punished.
By your officers?
By our own officers. Yeah, that was another horrible thing that happened. Of course, they used the methods of torture they had learned.
Yeah, they had been applying on the ground, on the continent.
Yeah, applying during the 70s.
Yeah. How long did you stay in the islands?
I stayed until the last group of prisoner of war.
I left mid-June.
The last group of POWs. If the dates are okay, Fernando, I left on June the 18th, 4 days after the war stopped. On the Norland, which was a ferry boat that was used by England to cross from the Canal de Mancha. And
where were you shipped to?
We navigated during practically 3 days, and we were shipped to the Puerto Madryn. I arrived at Puerto Madryn. We flew to the city of Buenos Aires and then to Campo de Mayo. And we were there two days and a half approximately, where we were bathed, changed our clothes, we ate, and they did some military intelligence asking us what we had seen, we had not seen, and we had to sign papers saying that we would not talk about the situation. Last thing I did was participating in burying our dead people also. That's why I didn't turn myself in.
You didn't?
I didn't turn myself in. When I escaped in that moment, and then when I was trapped by some British units and I started talking in English, they took me to bury the other. And then I was taken to the I was put in a group to go walking to the airport, but I never surrendered.
I understand.
I never surrendered sincerely. I don't remember saying I surrender or nothing at all. On the contrary, I remember cussing them out or having those actions, and when I opened my mouth in English, it was the worst thing I could have done. And then we were put in, we went to the airport, and we were put in some barns there that belonged to the Falkland Islands store, and then we were shipped back in the Norland. So I was in the first group, practically we could say that I was in the first group of people who arrived to the island, turn on the lights, and with the last group to turn off the lights.
You would try to steal food from the surrounding farms and houses of the islanders there?
Yes, also, I also did that, yes.
And you came in contact with them?
Yeah, there's a very nice story about a patrol I had to go with as an interpreter. We were sent to a farm to search the house.
That was at the end. Search you for guns, or sent you for?
Yeah, they sent me with a gun that worked. My gun didn't work. So we went to a house. We searched it, and I searched it. I started screaming in English. You know, is there anybody here? We just want to talk, and we leave. Fortunately, there was nobody in the house. And I remember, I have very fond memories of that. Of that day, the house was like, of course, we were starving, we were wet, we were cold, we were shivering.
And your gun didn't work?
My gun didn't work, and we had been very badly treated for 2 months. So suddenly I was in this beautiful house, very neat, very very comfy, homely place.
Cozy.
Cozy, yes. Although even the smells were like my mum's house or like my grandmother's house. So it was like connecting with the family, you know? And I remember I stole a pullover, which I kept for 25 years, and
You mean a jersey, a piece of clothing there?
Yes, an English pullover. Very nice, very with a lovely perfume. I remember smelling that and connecting with my mum. And when I left the farm, I said, I'm going to come back one day, and I'm going to say thank you to these people. I felt some kind of protection inside that house. I felt compassion towards the people, to all the islanders. I felt sorry for myself. I said, when is this going to end? But at the same time, I felt stronger. I remember I ate some Quaker oats and some butter I found around. I felt stronger, and I felt like there was somebody in the house telling me, take all this stuff, and you're going to survive, Michael, and you'll be
back
home.
You've got to tell the story.
You'll be back home soon. This was the 8th of June. The battle was the 11th. On the 14th, the surrender.
I lost two things. Number one, I lost around the month of May the possibility to project. For the people to understand this communication that we were having, we had been last week sending ourselves mails, organizing ourselves for this hour to be together. If I ask you now, what are you going to do in the afternoon? You'll say, well, I've got to do this. I've got to do another things. When you stop projecting, you make no plans.
Just think for the moment, for the
present. Exactly, because you don't know if you're going to have a future. And the other thing that you lose is the total. Normally, I don't know why, the human beings, we have the custom to take material things and make possession of them. Say, this is mine, this is my shirt, this is my book, this is my whatever. Well, you lose totally that reason of possession. The material things mean absolutely nothing to you. And then
You lost your youth.
We, from 18 to 19, we were like we were 40 or 50 years old. We lost our youth. And that is something we never recovered again. I had the opportunity to study university. In reality, Fernando, I believe that I took the study as a psychological way of putting my head in something else. Something that
totally
costed me a lot.
You didn't engage in a combat situation until the very final days with that, maybe the worst battle, which is Mount Langdon. Or you had previously encountered the British forces.
No, we had been bombarded during a month, but from the ships. And we had also attacks from the Sea Harriers. pass very, very close in recent flights over our heads. But the encounter was the 11th, the night of the 11th to 12th. And this patrol I was mentioning, we passed very, very near the entire three para regiment that was ready to attack us. This was the 8th, and the attack was the 11th, 3 days later. So they didn't shoot us because they wanted to keep the surprise element of their own attack.
How was that battle? I mean, was there any chance, or was just
well, it was the paras lost 23 soldiers that night and about 80 wounded. It was the British regiment with most casualties. And our regiment, the 7th Regiment of La Plata, also is the Argentine regiment with most casualties. We lost 36 and about 120 wounded. But it was absolutely crazy, with transmission during the night, freezing cold, full moonlight, no wind.
Was there any, I mean, like a command coming from your officers, or was just like blind shooting and...
No, yeah, it was crazy. It was so noisy you couldn't even hear anything.
What left me positive, yes, one thing, the only solution for mankind is peace.
You are certain about that?
No doubt about it. I never again in my life from there touched a gun. I don't want to see a gun. I want to have nothing to do with a gun or nothing that produces violence. I have a tremendous respect, and I show my daughters how to manipulate a knife, how to turn it around for us to not cut yourself to give it, because a knife in a hand to me signifies something else. I have a tremendous problem when I hear a plane overflying very, very, very low or with big noise. It feels like I want to deep down. So all those are negative. The positive going back would be peace is the solution. Negotiating, speaking, dialoguing. We can agree or disagree. That's okay. That's no problem.
But we don't need to shoot at each other.
Exactly. We don't need to shoot. We don't need to shout. And we don't need to insult.
The first thing I said about being a survivor, your perspective in life suddenly changes. I came back at I was 19. I had lost 20 kilos, but I was very mature. I had very clear what my life was going to be. And secondly, also, the experience of coming back with the British soldiers on the Canberra, the ship that brought us back to Patagonia. You know, it was like a sociological experiment.
Why is that?
What happened on the ship? Because we thought we would be angry with the British soldiers, and they also thought they wanted to throw us
over to the sea.
To the sea, but when we exchanged experiences, we became friends, and that was another lesson I learned during the war. If you have a human exchange, fighting a faceless enemy would be impossible. No, I think that if you put people to live. People of different countries with political problems, if you put them to live like in a hotel or in a ship and anything, to live together for a week, there would be never a war again.
I feel honored and I feel proud of defending my country. That is true. I would never do it again in the way that I do it, but I am proud of defending my country, and that I am proud of participating in that. In participating in defense of my country. I'm not proud of the violence. I'm not proud of many of other things that maybe happened during the war, but I do feel proud of defending my country. That's something that's true, and I believe the majority of the people who have fought on both sides, that pride, they have it. I have been quiet during many years. I didn't want to talk about this until I found a phrase that made Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine was an American writer of the 18th century, and I'll read it exactly, the words, because I think they're okay. It says, "If there must be trouble, let it be in my day, that my child may have peace."
The thing is about war. It's about pride. It's about not knowing the other person. I think, for example, what's happening now, 30 years on, with the islanders and the Argentines, they don't know each other. They don't speak. That's why there's still some kind of animosity, which would disappear with a normal situation.
Thank you very much for this.
On the contrary, Fernando, pleasure, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, I'm very glad I helped in any way, so a big hug to you, Fernando. So, bye-bye.
RAE, Argentina al mundo. RAE, Argentina, 面向世界.
RAE, Argentina vers le monde.
RAE, Argentina to the world.
RAE, 世界に向けて, Argentina.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
RAE, Argentinian in the world.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
That there, my friends, is one of the peaks of my professional career, talking to those two great men, Alejandro and Miguel, who were kind enough to give me that time back then in 2012. Hope you appreciated this interview as much as I enjoyed doing it and listening to it every time we replay it on the air. On the occasion of some anniversary related to Malvinas. We didn't have time to play this feature on Resolution 2065, the UN acknowledging the sovereignty dispute between Argentina and the UK, but we'll do that next week. But we do have time to listen to one more song that came to represent what Argentina felt after the war, which is what many countries experience, which is the need for peace and the need to avoid violence and find hope, calling war a monster, which is that's what it is at the end of the day. This is a song by Leon Gieco, perhaps his most important composition, a song that went around the world and has been translated to several languages. Here's the live version together with Victor Heredia of Solo Le Pido a Dios, I Only Ask of God, no more war.
desahuciado está el que tiene que marchar a vivir una cultura diferente. Solo le pido a Dios que la guerra no me sea indiferente. Es un monstruo grande y quizá fuerte. Toda la pobre inocencia de la gente. Es un monstruo grande y pisa fuerte. Toda la pobre inocencia de la gente.
RAE, Argentina al mundo. RAE, Argentina hacia el mundo.
RAE, Argentina vers le monde.
RAE, Argentina to the world.
RAE, 世界に向けて Argentina.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
RAE, Argentinian in the world.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
And with that, we come to the end of today's edition of RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior in English, for Wednesday, April 1st, 2026. Ana Maroto was our sound technician. My name is Fernando Farias. We're going on a long weekend because of Pascuas, Easter, Semana Santa, as we say in Spanish. So we're going to be back with a new show on Monday. Have an excellent weekend. Thank you for listening to us, and hasta la próxima.